Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Welcome to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I have the distinct pleasure of being with Dr. Samuel Bash, Professor of Psychiatry at Mount Sinai Medical School, an internationally known psychiatrist in the fields of psychological treatment for patients with medical disorders, psychopharmacology, and psychoanalysis. Stay with us and find that there are eureka cures for psychiatric disorders. Welcome to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I have the distinct pleasure of being with a renowned psychiatrist, Dr. Samuel Bash. Dr. Bash is a professor of psychiatry at Mount Sinai Medical School. He has an international reputation in the management of psychological diseases in patients with medical disease, psychopharmacology, and psychoanalysis. Dr. Bash, it's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, in your credits here, I listed a mouthful of things that you as a psychiatrist do. Can you perhaps put that in layman's terms for me?
Well, I practice general psychiatry, which means I take all patients who come. They range from people who have immediate problems in their family or relationships or problems at work to severe disorders such as schizophrenia, other psychoses, and so forth. In the course of my practice, I see, of course, many depressed patients, anxious patients. They're probably the most common variety of patients in terms of disorders.
So when you're talking about disorders, are there different types when you talk about mood or things like that? How do you classify them so people know how to start thinking about this?
Well, sometimes people divide them into thought disorders and mood disorders. The thought disorders would include something like schizophrenia, where the patient's internal circuits are out of order and they may hallucinate or have delusions or ideas of reference, which means they project out onto other people or objects what they're thinking as if they're externally sourced. And many other kinds of thought disorders that may not be psychotic, sometimes they're hard to differentiate. For example, the obsessive patient who has fixed thoughts about certain things that are irrational, or a panic disorder patient who is convinced he's going to lose control or go crazy or die or some other outcome to his severe physical distress. And there are various kinds of thought disorders. Mood disorders are more what are called in lay vernacular ups and downs. The ups are more manic type of behavior, or not uncommonly found what is called hypomanic behavior. Hypo, medicalese, is a reduced form of hyper. It's a lesser form. And there's a condition called cyclothymia, which I guess in lay terms is kind of a mini bipolar. It's mood swings, but not to the extremes.
And when you refer to bipolar, do you mean somebody that's extremely high and extremely low?
Usually not at the same time. They present in one or the other. And on the first episode, particularly of a depression, it's very hard to categorize them because you don't know if it's an ordinary depression, which may be a one-time-in-a-lifetime depression, or the beginning of a chronic depression disorder, or part of a larger picture of bipolar disorder. And you may not really be able to define that until the patient has a manic or at least a hypomanic episode. Hypomania, you know, sometimes it's easier to diagnose at first and you're able to tell. One of the problems with that is that we sometimes medically induce this. I've had a number of patients who were treated by non-psychiatrists who may not have been as aware of some effects of the antidepressants who had bipolar or cyclothymic patients. They give antidepressants, and they went into a manic episode because they weren't aware that these particular drugs can throw a bipolar patient into an abnormal state. And then sometimes I had to see them or hospitalize them or do what I had to do and medicate them or talk with them.
Let me ask you, let's take about a step back. You know, when we think of cancer, we think of cells that just start to divide and take over our body. Where does mental illness come from? Is it, you know, something happen?
Obviously, your question is complex. And I oftentimes think of it in terms of the biopsychosocial model, those three elements, the biological, the psychological, and the sociological. The biological is, first of all, genetic, that you may be programmed, as many psychiatric disorders are. Schizophrenia appears to be, bipolar disorders appear to be programmed, autism and several other conditions. And there are other biological factors. I mean, just prenatal care can affect a newborn, or perinatal care can affect the, as you know, in your field, the brain, the endocrine system, metabolic system, physiology, and that may act as a substrate for later life. Psychological has to do with early nurturing, relationship with the parents early in life, and what people are exposed to. People who are in deprived areas get short shrift. If they're endowed, if they're lucky genetically to be endowed with insights and intelligence and creativity and talents, that will help them through life. And they will also learn early to emulate or imitate the way parents or older people will cope with life. Intrapsychic mechanisms that people cope with or what psychiatrists call defenses, the way they deal with threats or danger or problems. And then the effects of other relationships, as especially earlier in life. Sociological means more what people meet in the outside world and their relationships with other people and whether they have confrontations with trauma or death or any kind of severe circumstances that may affect them, either acutely or chronically. The soldier at the front line in Iraq, or not in the front line, who's on a road and sees his best friends killed, who may never have had a psychiatric problem, is certainly going to respond to that. And under those circumstances, you almost expect a response, which we may categorize in the DSM-4, you know, as pathological, but...
The DSM-4 is, what is that?
Oh, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which gives the criteria for each condition that has to be met to make the correct diagnosis. And most of them are not absolute. If, for example, you have depression, they'll say you have to have a down mood and you have to not be interested in life. And then there are a whole slew of categories, and you only have to meet a certain number of them, mm-hmm. whether it's eating too much or too little, sleeping too much or too little, lack of libido, and feelings of guilt, worthlessness, helplessness, and so forth. You don't have to meet them all, but you have to meet a certain number to be categorized. Diagnoses are categorizations, right, to categorize people. Needless to say, as you know in your practice, you cannot categorize people, particularly human beings psychologically. You know, the insurance companies make you write down a number so that patients collect, but you know, people don't fit into slots very easily. And the most important thing about being a psychiatrist is that every person has to be individualized in every way. If you don't individualize the person, you miss the boat and you can't really help them.
You were talking a little bit about the, you know, the genetic component. Number one, the people that do have these, what I recall you saying is people that are bipolar and schizophrenia and maybe autism, those categories can be genetically linked. Do those patients need to get genetic counseling if they're going to go on to have children? Are they usually willing to do that? You know, how should we as society be involved in that?
It's very complex, and you have to be very careful about this. Several years ago, I actually made a house call. I don't want to identify somebody, so I'll have to try to modify a little bit in my description of somebody who had a genetic disorder that causes psychosis. Mm-hmm. And I saw this young man, and the mother confided in me about the family history of this disturbance. And they didn't want to tell the young man. And I was at odds as what to do. Eventually, I got off the hook when the mother confided to me that the father, who was the carrier, was not the real father of the boy. So it took me off the hook. But it is problematic about discouraging people from reproducing. I mean, it's a very, you know, there's a eugenics element, and it's very difficult, you know, as a physician to be telling people, and a psychiatrist, it's a no-no to tell people what to do. I mean, you just, you know, it becomes very, very difficult. The other thing about the genetic part, which is, I think, much more common than inheriting genes for schizophrenia or bipolar, is the diathesis, what the doctors call it, the predisposition that makes people more susceptible or more liable to have a disease, which is a much more common factor. So someone who...
And is that susceptibility environmental or biologic or...?
I think there's a genetic component of susceptibility, of predisposition. Some people may be predisposed to get a certain condition, but if they go through life and they're not like the boys who see their friends blown up on the road in Iraq, nothing ever happens. They breeze through life, and their predisposition is never expressed. Some people are so finely tuned, it doesn't take much to flick them over the edge into a psychiatric disorder. Their predisposition is so shaky, and other people have from great predisposition to very little predisposition, and it takes a lot more to push them over the edge. They can withstand more stress and threat from the environment without becoming disturbed.
Before, you referred to, you know, the Iraqi soldier walking down the street and seeing his friend blown up by a road bomb. There's a lot of interest, obviously, now in soldiers coming back from the war. Is there a way to measure, like, am I, if I'm an Iraqi soldier, likely to have some type of psychiatric break if I see my friend die versus my friend next to me?
Very difficult, because somebody who is psychologically very well defended may not be able to withstand an extreme trauma. And that's pretty extreme, watching your friends blown up next to you. The same person, if they, for example, had a death in the family, might be distressed, but they wouldn't go over the edge. Whereas someone might have a post-traumatic stress disorder exposed to an extreme following 9/11 and Iraq and so forth, where people are challenged and their defenses are challenged. Some make it and some don't.
We'll be right back with Dr. Samuel Bash to talk more about how psychiatrists determine when to treat you with medicine or when to talk to you. Please stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm with Dr. Samuel Bash, an internationally acclaimed psychiatrist who is professor of psychiatry at Mount Sinai Medical School. He is most interested in the psychological treatment of patients with medical disorders, psychopharmacology, and psychoanalysis. Tell me, how, when you first interact with a patient, do you make the decision? I don't think we can get into diagnosis. We'll assume you make the diagnosis, but then at what point do you decide this patient just needs to talk to me, this patient needs medication? How do you go through that process?
First, as you point out, the diagnosis is essential, and that may influence the treatment, of course, as in any field of medicine. You can't treat anybody without a diagnosis. Any treatment plan which evolves after gathering as much information as possible for the diagnosis from the patient, from the family members, from any other sources, other doctors, laboratory tests, whatever information to put it together to get a correct diagnosis, of course, influences the treatment. And it hasn't been rare for me to pick up a medical cause for psychiatric disorders. You know from your field, an acoustic neuroma, a temporal lobe tumor can cause auditory hallucinations, and you can have organic brain syndrome from a multitude of brain disorders.
Organic brain syndrome is?
It's a non-psychological disturbed thinking caused by interference with the functioning of the brain, the anatomy, the physiology, metabolism, things that you deal with. And the psychiatrist may not be the correct doctor for these people. And also, a number of times I've picked up endocrine disorders. Thyroid is a major culprit. And adrenal gland, various kind of other disorders which can cause psychiatric.
So abnormal hormone levels in patients can cause.
Right. So making the diagnosis before you decide the treatment, it may be that I'm not even going to do the treatment. I have to. If I make the diagnosis that it's a medical condition, they have to see another doctor. They may continue seeing me if they have any consequences psychologically from the diagnosis or disorder. The diagnosis gets very difficult. One of my interests is lupus, lupus erythematosus, and I'll get a patient who comes in disturbed. The patient may have premorbid personality problems or neurotic problems.
By premorbid, you mean existing before they develop the lupus?
Absolutely, gotcha. Yeah. Then they develop a chronic illness, and they are disturbed by having a chronic illness. People who are previously healthy and functioning, and they can't bear being burdened by this illness, then they may have lupus cerebritis, which is an inflammation of the brain caused by the lupus, which may cause or mimic a psychiatric disorder, and then they have treatment. They may have steroids, which are notorious for causing psychological problems in patients. I see a number of patients like that because I treat patients with medical conditions, ulcerative colitis patients and other. I'm consultant of the not at the present, but for many, many years, the organ transplant unit where they use high doses of drugs and they would cause problems. So the differential diagnosis is very difficult when you have somebody with all these conditions existing at the same time to sort out what is what. So that's the.
And by differential diagnosis, you're kind of. That means your list of possibilities as you're sitting and talking with me, you're running this checklist, boom, boom, boom.
Right, yep. Right. My computer's running in my brain. What is causing this? And how many units of chronic illness is contributing to disturbance, and how many units of cerebritis is, you know, it's very hard to figure out what is the main culprit in a disturbance, and you have to take everything into account. Or I see cancer patients, that's one of my interests, and you have people who, of course, if someone gets chemo and they lose their hair and they're debilitated and so forth, they're going to have psychological problems. And, of course, they're terrified of dying, and there are built-in problems to some of these disorders. So when I see someone with a medical illness, you have to kind of know the syndrome or know what patients are preoccupied. And sometimes patients don't bring up these issues, particularly life and death issues. People don't like to talk about dying or death, and you can't voice that on them.
You've emphasized a couple of times that you deal with a lot of patients that have other medical problems, and then they come to see you because of the psychological associations or ramifications of that disease. Man, I'm assuming that, you know, cancer that's spread throughout the body, like you said, lupus, the autoimmune disease is something that you're extremely familiar with. What is the most common psychiatric problem that you see as a result of these medical problems? Is it depression or?
Depression, of course, is very common. And one of the problems with depression is the whole concept of when things are normal or not normal. Is it normal to be depressed when you're confronted with a serious illness? And even if it is an appropriate response, people can still get help with it. And I'm a very big advocate of people playing their strong suits. And when people are threatened with something, I help to call on whatever they've used in the past, and they're not even aware of what intrapsychic mechanisms or defenses they have to deal with things, or to mobilize other people in their lives, or whatever they have to do to deal with this so that they aren't defeated by a disease or depression.
When I think of a person who's depressed, it's an individual that isn't necessarily able to have the motivation to do what's right. So what do we do for the patient that does have this chronic debilitating disease? How can the family members help them? And what's the appropriate thing to do? I mean, if they don't want to see you as a psychiatrist, the patient, I don't know whether that would be a positive interaction. What should families look for, and what can they do to help get that patient to you?
Families usually know if a patient is depressed and their family member is depressed. They know that person. They know they've changed and they're immobilized or they lost their interest in life or they're withdrawn or whatever. Of course, I cannot help anybody if I don't see them. That's a problem. Sometimes family members drag their family members in to see me or drag them to the hospital or wherever. And, you know, it's very hard because you, in our country, you don't force people against their will to do things. And there are serious implications to that. You just don't go around saying, you know, tell the police to bring them over here. I mean, it doesn't work like that. You have to be sensitive to all those issues. And people have their rights, even if they're depressed or anxious. Another common, and you see this preoperatively, when people have a condition, they get very frightened and anxious, and they sometimes think about the worst or fix on the worst. And sometimes they're too anxious to come to see me or too depressed, and there are other reasons. But it does pose a problem for the family because I can't drag them there, and it's illegal for the most part for anybody to drag them.
Are there any quick little tricks we can give the listeners that they can use to coax or motivate their loved ones?
I think the main motivation is for the patient to think and know that their loved ones care about them, maybe more than they care about themselves at the moment, and that everything is in their own best interest. And for that to be communicated to the patient, that maybe they are compromised now, you know, but we love you and we want you to get help and we want you to be healthy and whole. And you have to get help. You have to see a doctor. And the most powerful instrument is the relationship.
We talked about this a little bit during the break, you know, that the stigma of seeing a psychiatrist, you know, the patient who may justifiably be depressed because of their medical illness. How can the family help them get over that stigma? What can they say or do?
I think by direct communication. The stereotype is that you don't see a psychiatrist unless you're, quote, crazy, and quote, whatever that condition is or is supposed to be. But in our day and age, people come to see a psychiatrist for personal issues and problems in relationships and so forth. And the patient has to be appealed to on the basis of it doesn't mean, you know, they're off the deep end. It means they need help and they can get help, and help is available in our modern day and age. Medicine and psychiatry has developed to a point where there are possibilities of getting help. And again, the only thing that can convince them to accept and trust the family member is the relationship. If they don't have a trusting relationship with the family member, they're not likely to respond.
when you're dealing with a patient, any one of your psychiatric patients, what importance do you put on family in that treatment?
A great deal when I can. I can't always. First of all, there's confidentiality, and most patients don't want anything to leave the room, and it never does. I'm a stickler for confidentiality, and nothing leaves that room. And unless there was a danger involved, you know, suicide or homicide, nothing can leave that room. Oftentimes, particularly with medically ill people, they need help. And a lot of people don't like dependency. People spend their lives trying to become independent adults, and when you're ill, you regress and you need to be taken care of, and it's difficult for people to accept that, but family members have to be involved. At times when people come in and a family member accompanies them, I often will ask them in the waiting room, would you like to be accompanied in? You want to come in yourself? I'll give them the choice. And for a variety of reasons, people sometimes will bring in a family member, and sometimes a family member is crucial to the recovery. On the other hand, I've seen more than once where a family member is destructive. There's a classic psychiatric syndrome called folie à deux, where the so-called disturbed patient and another family member are cooperating in the disturbance, and the other person is the enabler. The classic is, of course, alcoholism. Or there's a folie à famille, or my French, I don't have any French, but where the whole family is involved, and they may promote a disorder or at least cooperate with a disorder. But most often, almost always, the family is helpful. And when they can be engaged, when it is appropriate, and when the patient wants them to be engaged, which is the key, I think family can be very helpful in the recovery. If you have a very disturbed person who's lost their judgment, you really do need a family member involved.
Just as an aside, what we were talking about earlier, thinking about The Sopranos with Tony Soprano talking with his psychiatrist. Is that a true scenario? If a psychiatrist heard about someone killing people, what's their moral obligation in that situation?
You have to protect the public. You can't let anybody get killed. And I'm not going to go into some of the situations I've had, but there have been positions I've been in where I've had to make a judgment about what to do. And as in all of medicine, you're making judgments every day. You know, what's best for the patient in particular, that's your primary responsibility. But sometimes if a patient is a danger to the public, life-threatening, all bets are off. I mean, you're legally required and ethically required to break the confidentiality for life or death matters. And, you know, if I have a suicidal patient, I'm not going to keep that a secret from the family.
Right. You know, back to the chronic disease. And again, I keep fixating on if you're dying of something or you've got a disease that just completely ruins your life, it's not bad to be depressed. I mean, it's bad to be depressed if you can't function. But how do we get people over that hump? You know, all right, I understand that I'm depressed, and then they come and see you. I mean,
it's very interesting in terms of individuals. Every person is different, and they have different mechanisms and different defenses. What comes to mind, I had one patient who was a major partner in a major firm, who was very successful and eminent and who spent most of his life being successful and neglected his family, more or less. And he got stricken with severe illness. And I don't know how else to put it. He kind of changed his values. He decided to stop working, spent all of his time with his family, with his loved ones who still loved him, with some resentment at the neglect over the years, but he made his remaining days happier by shifting his thinking and his values and figuring out a little bit more about what life is all about rather than just, you know, being narcissistically successful.
Now, do you think that happened just because he came to some conclusion, the light all of a sudden went on, or was there an interaction with you that led to that?
I met him when he was severely depressed. We talked about these issues, And although I don't tell people what to do, I do raise these issues for people to think about. And there's a big difference between raising issues and telling people what to do. Just because you can't tell people what to do doesn't mean things can't be discussed, because they can dismiss everything that comes up in conversation if they choose. I would say the discussions were related. I can't say it all came from our discussions. He was probably ready psychologically to be a little more introspective, because he wasn't a very introspective person. He was forced to be more introspective, so it probably was brewing, developing, and then maybe our discussions brought it more to the fore.
But I think that this is what gets at the core of psychiatry, as I see it. You know, when do you use medicine? Boom, and then presumably the medicine will work. Versus when do you guide the patient through whatever their abnormal thinking is, or whatever they've been doing that's bad for themselves and their family? And structurally, how do you put that conversation together so eventually, boom, the light goes on?
Yeah, obviously that's complicated. As you mentioned, I do summer psychopharmacology, but I don't do it without continuing discussions. I am a psychoanalyst, and I will still talk problems out. And my own orientation is, when you talk problems out, you have them for life. You have the solutions for life. When you plug in a medicine, people feel better. When they stop the medicine, you don't know what's going to happen. And I prefer the talking treatment as a more permanent way of resolving conflicts and problems. However, I prescribe, and in this day and age, it's be unkind not to prescribe people who are suffering terribly, especially for faster results.
Have you made any observations, though? Can you all of a sudden see, I'm getting close, next week when I see them, I bet they turn the corner? Can you feel that happening?
There are not that many eurekas. There are many more slow process of change. That's why psychotherapy takes time, because people really have to work things out within themselves. I mean, I've had a few eurekas over the course of the years, but most often it's a process. And a lot of people don't understand it when they come in treatment and they think, oh, you're a psychiatrist, you're just going to want to keep me in here forever, see me and all that. Now, on the first meeting, there's really a contract between me and the patient. Some patient will come in and say, I don't like drugs, I don't want to use drugs, they're out. I say, okay, we'll talk about it. And other people say, you know, I want a fast fix. I don't really want to see a psychiatrist. You know, what can you do for me? You know, usually in those circumstances, they call me doc. What can you do for me, doc? Anyway, it has to be with the patient in mind. And, you know, with my knowledge of this is going to take longer or shorter, how much a patient is going to suffer, can they abide it? And I'll make my diagnosis, as we discussed earlier, but I'll never embark on a treatment plan without discussing with the patient and explaining to the patient the implications of what the treatment entails. And even I often will explain that the treatment may fail, and, you know, then often there'll be discussion of side effects and so forth. And it's not uncommon for either patients, before they see me or I have a discussion with them, if they want to check the internet about the drug. I think it's good to be informed. The more informed my patients are, the better. Better for them and better for me. It's easier when they understand these things.
We're going to have to take a brief break from How to Save Your Life. I'm with Dr. Samuel Bash. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm with Dr. Samuel Bash, an internationally acclaimed psychiatrist from Mount Sinai Medical School. Before the break, we were talking about medication and its treatment in psychiatric diseases and the positive and negative aspects of these medications. During the break, this led to the discussion of the concept of psychopharmacology. That's a mouthful. Can you, explain to us what psychopharmacology is?
It's the use of medication to treat psychiatric conditions. There are a variety of medications and a variety of conditions. These days, there's more sophistication about this. People understand things that didn't understand 20 or 30 years ago about neurotransmitters, which are specific brain chemicals involved with both healthy and disordered functioning of the brain. With the more common conditions like depression and anxiety, there are only a handful of neurotransmitters that are really being used and studied and incorporated into drug treatment. They're what they call the catecholamines. You're very familiar with that. Norepinephrine, which is noradrenaline, like from the adrenal gland, mm-hmm. or dopamine, which is, people know L-DOPA used for Parkinsonism, and other major neurotransmitter like serotonin. People know it's in the lay vernacular because everybody knows about SSRIs, antidepressants, and gamma aminobutyric acid, and a few others small, but they're just a handful that are mainly concentrated on and being worked on. And they work in very specific part of the brains, and current technology research can focus those, the limbic system, the amygdala, certain parts of the brain where these drugs are metabolized. And even in those parts of the brain where they're concentrated, they're still in very, very small amounts, like in where they're concentrated might be 3% or 5%. I don't think it probably doesn't go up above 15%. And when they develop drugs, they're more designer drugs that work on those chemicals in those part of the brains. And if someone gets a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, what that means, the reuptake is a place where the drug is broken down and the inhibitor stops it from being broken down. So that's the way the serotonin drugs work. And others combine working in these systems. They will deal with serotonin system or the norepinephrine system.
What specific types of diseases or patients that have this disorder should be looking for a psychopharmacologist? So if I'm told that I've got, an anxiety disorder, should I start thinking maybe I need a psychopharmacologist, a person that specializes in it?
Generally, if you go to a neurosurgeon who specializes in a certain kind of disorder, they'll have much more experience. They've probably made more of their mistakes earlier. So you try to find a person who does specialize. You'll have better luck with somebody than someone who's a novice and, experimenting on you. So it's better to see someone who's experienced with the use of medication. The choice of medication is sometimes difficult. Every medication has side effects, and some of them are very serious. Some of the antidepressants, if they're misused, can cause a hypertensive crisis, could cause a stroke and kill people.
High blood pressure and bleeding in the brain.
Yeah, and many of them have other serious consequences.
So I'm getting the sense that you don't think, or do you, that there? If I'm told that I've got bipolar disorder and it's going to need medication, should I seek the attention of a psychopharmacologist because it's going to require fine manipulation of the medication, or can I see a general psychiatrist?
I think you'd be better off seeing a person experienced with the treatment, because almost every drug used for bipolar has very serious toxic consequences. Mm-hmm. One has a blood disorder that can kill you. Some have permanent, irreversible neurologic side effects, and all the way down the line. So you have to be careful. One of the interesting things about the drugs for bipolar is many of them were not approved, at least initially, for treatment of bipolar. Many of them were approved for epilepsy. Mm-hmm. And they stop brain discharges, which may have some equivalence with bipolar illness. And many of the anti-epilepsy drugs are used by psychiatrists for bipolar, and quite effectively. Mm-hmm. Then there's a whole other category of drugs, which are antipsychotic drugs for schizophrenia and psychotic disorders. The older ones are called typical antipsychotics, and they would cause permanent, irreversible neurologic damage if used, in particularly over a period of time. A whole new group of drugs was developed, which have fewer damages to neurology and neurologic system of the body, but they have their own serious side effects. Many of them cause obesity and diabetes and other conditions which can be serious. So every drug has to be treated very, very carefully. I think of every drug as a potential toxin. And when I prescribe something, I'm always worried about the side effects. And side effects are not that rare, even though, you know, when you read the PDR, the physician's desk reference, it's 1% or 3% or 5%. But, you know, when you get them, they're 100%.
Then it's 100%, yeah.
So you have to be careful with these drugs.
Let's get back to the talking therapy and just more to you specifically. One of the reasons I didn't go into psychiatry is I didn't know if I'd be able to stay awake and deal with a patient that I might not just like. How do you cope with that? How do you deal with the difficult patient? Do you tell them to get another doctor? Or?
I don't think I've ever had that situation. I like people, and I give them the benefit of the doubt. The other thing is, as a psychiatrist, you're trained that people may have disturbances. And if I get somebody who has disturbances, such as they can't get along with anybody, when they see me, I'm going to almost presume that they're not going to get along with me. Mm-hmm. And they're either going to try to provoke me or get me to reject them or try to do something like that. And I have to abide it and be patient and make interpretations and, you know, let them know that maybe they're trying to do to me what they've done before in other relationships.
So immediately you break it down into the diagnosis of, you know, they're difficult to get along with, and you start thinking about it clinically. What happens when you go home at night?
Well,
can you turn that off?
Well, like you, Dr. Stieg, I have to think about my patients when I'm off duty, because your brain doesn't shut off. And I do have a good time, and, you know, with my family, and I enjoy time off, and I appreciate leisure and getting away. But, you know, when you're a doctor, I think in a way you have to take your problems home with you. You have to think about your patient. What are you going to do? And, you know, I can't always figure things out in that hour. You know, I get a lot of information.
Yeah, the point I was referring to is what my family always says to me is, you know, you're a surgeon. You know, you're always trying to fix things right away. How do you go home? As you said, the patient comes into you who doesn't get along with people. So you're assuming they're not going to try to get along with you. So immediately you go into your clinical mode. How do you not do that when you get home and just say, I'm going to be Sam Bash?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I do that pretty automatically. However, you know, if I go to a party or somewhere, people think of me as a psychiatrist and they'll come over, and people often volunteer their problems to me.
Right.
And that will take me away from just having a good time at the party. Right. When, you know, I'm polite and diplomatic about it. But, you know, I love my work. I try not to burden myself excessively and to have a balanced life. I like to practice what I preach as best I can. And I'm fairly able to do it. And I have a good family, so, and I enjoy them. That helps a lot.
They help you break away.
Yeah.
Earlier, you were talking about some, quote, eureka events. Describe one for me.
Well, I had a patient in analysis for a while, and she was actually working on a problem, so there was a process going. She was a woman who had always picked bad relationships. She always picked the wrong men. Mm-hmm. And she had this terrible dream of all these, it was an actual dream, she reported on, in the analysis, of men misusing her and torturing her and abusing her and doing all kinds of things. And
she knew it was a dream.
Oh, it was a dream. Yeah, okay. Oh, she reported it as a dream, and she analyzed it. And she's, you know, so I'm going to wipe my hands of this. I'm done with it. And she stopped seeing the men who were not in her best interest. And she ended up marrying a great guy who was loving and caring and, you know, so forth. So it was following that dream, and it was a urethra, but it was also part of a process, too, because, you know, it had to lead up to something. But she woke up and started a new life, so to speak.
So one day she said, I'm not going to have this dream anymore?
I'm not going to see these guys anymore. I'm going to have a good relationship.
Okay, so it was the men she was seeing that led to this dream.
Right.
So how does that make you feel? Is that what keeps you going every morning?
Well, the eurekas are few and far between. That can't keep me going because I'd have to wait a long time for the eurekas. Like you, Dr. C, it's a privilege to be a doctor. It is a great privilege. My son was thinking of going to medical school. He said, Dad, do you really enjoy practicing much as it seems? I said, yes. I said, sometimes I can't believe it. I help people. They're grateful for it, and then they pay me for it. I said, it's wonderful. I get people in treatment sometimes who are, you know, Wall Street people who make fortunes, and they're miserable, and they're looking for something else to give meaning to their life and so forth. I have automatic meaning in my life. I mean, I help people, and they generally appreciate it. I mean, there's some who don't, of course. But it's gratifying, and that's what keeps me going.
You also said that you, just a little tidbit about me, is I actually struggled between becoming a neurosurgeon or a child psychiatrist when I was making my decision, and I made the choice that I made. With psychoanalysis, I think a lot of people's perspective of that is a Woody Allen movie, you know,
right.
Where he goes, which probably is not an accurate assessment. If someone is thinking about it, but they're scared because they don't want to be labeled, What are we talking about with psychoanalysis? What kind of commitment? What does it really mean?
It's a very specialized form of treatment. It only comprises a small amount of my practice. It has to be the right person who is very committed to deeper change. You know, psychoanalysis is for a more permanent, deeper change. It's a more profound treatment.
Is it for certain disease processes?
It's not for psychotic disorders. It is definitely not for that. It is for neurotic disorders, or personality disorders.
Behavioral disorders?
Could be.
Yeah.
And the person has to be patient and has to be introspective and be willing to give their resources, their money, their time, and their energy to working out a deeper problem. And only a small fragment of the population, frankly, I think has the capacity to do that. It takes a lot of capacity. Introspection is difficult. Really probing deeply into yourself. Most people spend their lives avoiding that. Yeah. And people, you know, don't like to get too deep. So it takes a special kind of person.
So explain to me what you mean by a neurotic person. You know, it sounds like they'd be a perfect person for psychoanalysis. What does a neurotic person do?
Yeah. You mean what are the kinds? I mean, there are a whole variety of kinds of neuroses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, there are all kinds of personality problems, personality types, dependent personalities and avoidant personalities.
Someone that avoids doing things, or they always put themselves in dependent positions.
They could, yes, yeah. And it could be that thing. There is another category of people where they may not really need psychoanalysis, even though if they have, for example, a phobia, you might be able to work that out by behavioral treatment and or medication. They may not need to go in psychoanalysis. That is a neurotic condition. Some neurotic conditions do better without psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is definitely not the cure-all, nor is any individual treatment. One of the reasons there are so many kinds of treatments is that one size doesn't fit all. Mm-hmm. As we discussed earlier, you have to individualize what will work for that person. And when I do an interview, at the end of that interview, I will suggest what the options are.
Is it common for you to see a patient that has one psychiatric diagnosis or multiple?
When you go to medical school, they teach you how to do an intake history, and you do it the same as I do. Chief complaint, history of present illness, past history, medical history, so forth. There's all doctors, whatever specialty they're in, do the same thing. The chief complaint is focused on. You have to work on what the patient presents themselves with. It's not uncommon for someone to come in for a chief complaint, and after they've come two or three times, they say, oh my God, that's not really my problem. I really have to work out this problem. And so they have more than one area. But you must concentrate on the chief complaint, what the patient comes in to see the doctor for. All doctors have to do that. Whatever else goes along with the package, you deal with the best you can.
Yeah, I mean, I was getting at, yeah, they might have the chief complaint, but they also have other illnesses, so it means that you have to have a multi-pronged kind of therapy.
I believe in a multi-pronged therapy. Yeah. And as I said, it's not uncommon when I have people on medication and I'm talking to them. And if I need to send them to a behavioralist, I send them to a behavioralist or whatever is necessary. Sometimes a cognitive behavioral therapy is preferable to any kind of psychoanalytic type of therapy. I mean, each person is different and each treatment is different.
Well, Dr. Bash, it's been a distinct pleasure to have you here with us. I'm sure that the listeners are enlightened now about psychopharmacology and the advantages of psychoanalysis, and most importantly, that it isn't bad to see a psychiatrist in the setting of a chronic illness. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and neurosurgeon-in-chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Ken Ipp is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Shartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.